Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. An estimated 113 million people voted in the 2018 midterms, making this the first midterm in history to exceed over 100 million votes. As election results continue to pour in with increasingly bad news for Republicans, President Trump seems worried more and more about facing several investigations into him and his administration by the new Democratic majority in the House. This election gives us some clues about how the Trump presidency has been realigning American politics. In his latest piece for Harper's Magazine, called Rebirth of a Nation, Can States' Rights Save Us from a Second Civil War?, Jonathan Taplin explores the implications of our current situation. And I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Taplin to our show now. Hello.
Good to be here, Leonard.
You ask, what if we think of Trump as an interrex, the Oliver Cromwell of American history? Well, Cromwell's regime was a rather bloody period in British history. In what ways do you see parallels with our current situation?
Well, the term that historians have used is an interregnum, which means a time when the old is dying and the new cannot be born. And I think that it's a pretty good description of where we are now. Obviously, the old Republican coalition of white rural voters, the conservative movement conservatism is kind of broken. Trump doesn't believe in any of that. So all of that is kind of falling apart. And obviously, you look at the demography of the statistics this morning were announced that the millennial generation, the majority is non-white. So that is dying, and yet a new politics has not yet come out of that. And that is the place we're in. I believe that the Trump movement is kind of a rearguard attempt to hold on to something that doesn't really exist anymore. And, of course, he is aided in that by the fact that the Senate is set up for minority rule. As Norm Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute has pointed out, in 2040, 70% of Americans will live in 15 states. And that means that 70 votes in the Senate will be held by small, rural, older, whiter electorates in very small states.
Chosen by 30% of the voters, you say, he says.
Yeah. So 30% of the voters will control the Senate. And that's just an intolerable situation, which, from my point of view, in the past led to conflicts, obviously the Civil War being the greatest one, but also the period in the 1890s when there was a populist revolt. But I don't think we need to go there. And so what I'm trying to suggest is what we need to embrace as progressives is a kind of federalist solution, a progressive federalism that essentially says if California wants to have different laws than Trump wants on gun control or privacy or net neutrality or auto emissions or even immigration, it should be able to do that. Thomas Jefferson said we are individual states and to everything in terms of internally to the states, and we are knighted as to everything looking outward towards foreign nations. So we have a State Department, a Defense Department, a Treasury, but the states ought to have much more freedom to, experiment.
But can we say that there's also an interregnum within the Democratic Party? Just look at what's happening with Nancy Pelosi, with both new members of Congress on the left and the right saying they're not going to support her.
Well, obviously, to my mind, the Democratic leadership is needs to change. I mean, this is, you know, kind of looks like the Politburo during the Andropov era, where you have, you know, people in their late 70s, early 80s, running a party, which is, quite frankly, if it's going to have a future, it's going to be a young party, that is filled with people of color and women, gays, whatever. And this is not representative. I mean, Steny Hoyer and Nancy Pelosi are not representative of the Democrat Party that needs to be. And so in that sense, yes, we are in an interregnum there as well.
And we're seeing many prominent conservatives like George Will, Rick Schmidt, Max Boot, abandoning the Republican Party. Are they the equivalent of the Whigs today?
Well, that's my theory. You know, the Whig Party, you know, elected four presidents, but eventually just disappeared because it was taken over by a kind of anti, a pro-slavery side. And so people like Lincoln abandoned the party completely and formed a new party, the Republican Party, and the Whigs eventually disappeared. And what Trump's capture of the Republican Party has done is to make it into something that people like George Will or Max Boot don't recognize anymore, and they don't want to have anything to do with it. So my hope is that perhaps, and I know your audience is pretty progressive, but the notion of the Democratic Party as a big tent is, to me, really interesting. That, you know, you could win a Senate seat in Alabama. You might even, in the next few weeks, win a Senate seat in Mississippi. And yet you still have very progressive senators in California and other places. Now, they don't all have to agree on everything. And if the National Party sees itself as having a few ideas and essentially embracing the notion of localism, that California should look different than Mississippi, and that maybe the education system in Maine is quite different from that in New Mexico. And that's okay, because as Justice Brandeis said, is the brilliance of the Federalist idea was that a single state can experiment without harming the whole country. And that's what we need. We need the kind of bottom-up, move power to the edges experimentation that we've seen in other parts of the economy.
Well, before we get to how the states can do that, I just want to stick with what we were talking about. George Will and Steve Schmidt urged moderate Republicans to help create a Democratic majority in the recent midterms as a check on Trump. But first of all, do you think they had much of an influence? And second of all, how would they fit into a party that is also electing people identifying themselves as democratic socialists?
Well, look, it depends on whether you feel that there has to be some kind of absolute, rigorous national, platform for all Democrats to run on. But it's been proven that the success in the 28 election was that the National Party allowed individual candidates to run on the issues that worked in their region, and that worked both in the congressional races and even in, you know, Arizona Senate races. So, I mean, I think this notion that we have to agree on everything is a mistake. This republic is too big. The notion that every state, you know, has to agree on everything is just, to my mind, fallacious. Now, look, I don't want to go as far as the writer in New York Magazine this week who suggests that we break up the country into two parts. That seems to me be ridiculous. But there is no reason why the policies, whether it's in environmental policies or gun control or all of those kind of things, can't differ between different states.
But then we have a situation that the situation that was faced by Joe Manchin and Heidi Heitkamp with the Kavanaugh vote, they chose to, well, one chose to be politically expedient, the other chose not to. She lost.
But look, here's the problem. You know, South Dakota is going to probably stay a Republican state for the foreseeable future as far as the Senate vote is concerned. Now, the very fact that South Dakota is shrinking in the number of people, but it still has two senators, is just the problem I'm discussing.
Hasn't somebody pointed out that there are more people going through Grand Central Station on any given day than live in South Dakota?
I'm sure that's true. But, you know, it's obviously it's a flaw of the founders, and we both know why they did it. You know, many of the people who wrote the Constitution were allied with Virginia and states that were holding slaves, and they understood that the population centers were going to be in Massachusetts and New York. And so they wanted to have equal representation in the Senate, even if they had a far fewer people. And the irony, of course, was that they also wanted the slaves to count as two-thirds of a person for a census point of view in terms of doling out, you know, congressional seats, even though the slaves couldn't vote. So, I mean, we understand it's a flaw, but the notion that we're going to have some kind of constitutional convention to fix that and to fix the Electoral College, I think is just dreaming. Why would South Dakota give up its rights to have two senators? It's not going to do it. And why would Wyoming give up its power in the Electoral College, where an average citizen of Wyoming has three times the voting power of the average citizen of California? It's just not going to happen.
Because
then we have to say, what are we going to do?
Because it would have to either originate in the Senate or the states would have to vote for a change in the Constitution. The electoral...
They're not going to vote themselves out of power. There's no way that Wyoming and South Dakota and North Dakota are going to say, okay, we give up. It's just not going to happen. And people who think that that's some kind of solution are crazy.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Taplin, whose latest article is the... in the Harper's current issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called Rebirth of a Nation. Can states' rights save us from a second civil war? And later we'll talk a bit about the states' rights angle. But I was wondering whether President Trump has destroyed the regime of conservatives that has dominated the Republican Party since the election of Ronald Reagan, maybe even going back to Barry Goldwater.
Yeah, completely. Okay, so Republicans used to believe in free trade. Republicans used to believe in fiscal discipline.
They were opposed to deficits.
Trump doesn't believe in anything. He runs the economy kind of like he ran those casinos in Atlantic City. Run up as much debt as you possibly can. I mean, he once told a bank that was suing him for thing, I told you that deal was terrible. You should have never lent me the money. You know, I mean, he doesn't care. And so, you know, the Republicans passed a horrendous tax cut saying that it would actually bring in more money into the Treasury. They all knew that was a lie. Mitch McConnell knew it was a lie. And yet, you know, they continued to push it through because, needless to say, the people they were working for was Adelson and Koch and Mercer.
It's based on trickle-down economic theory, and that's not new with Donald Trump, but it was proven to not work, and yet it continued to be a part of the Republican thinking. So was movement conservatism already dying on its own? Has Trump just accelerated its demise, or has he been playing a major role in killing it?
I think he played a major role in killing it. I mean, I would suggest that in the January of 2016, George Will and Steve Schmidt and Max Boot would have considered themselves Republicans. And they don't consider themselves that anymore. So it's a relatively rapid demise of movement conservatism. And at least, you know, obviously I have a lot of beef with movement conservatism, but at least they had a few principles that they believed in. You know, one of which is that you don't, you know, just run up a deficit for no reason. You know, and so this is, you know, essentially a plutocracy that we're living through. And plutocracies are hard to pull off because it means that a very small percentage of the people get to rule the nation. And, you know, one of the things you absolutely need in plutocracies is a propaganda organization to convince a lot of people who are on the in the middle that it's in their benefit to give the very rich huge tax cuts. You also need, obviously, as much voter suppression as you possibly can, and you also need to distract most people and get a huge percentage of people to not vote. It was in that final thing that they were less successful this year than they have been in the past. For reasons that your guess is as good as mine, a bunch of young people began to vote. You know, when I looked at the statistics before the election, the average voting percentage of, say, a 20-year-old or a 22-year-old was about 20%. And it went up to about 33% this year. So that's a big change. Now, obviously, the average person my age in their 60s or 70s votes at about a 65 to 70% rate. So it's still, you know, we're being run by the oldsters, but something is changing, and that's a good sign.
I still wonder about why millennials resist voting. When I reached voting age, I was anxious to start voting. It just seemed to me to be part of growing up. It was like
you and I
being able to go into
age,
a bar and show my draft card and get some booze.
We actually forced them to lower the voting age to 18, right?
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was 21 in the 50s. So, I mean, that's how much we wanted to vote. So, I mean, look, I wrote a book called Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook, Google, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. I make the argument in that book that part of what social networks do is just distract people. They're just a huge time suck, and they make you think that whatever Kanye West's latest obsession is more important than politics. That's, you know, kind of a classic notion that, you know, Aldous Huxley had when he wrote Brave New World, that one of the ways to control the populace is just to distract them. And, you know, maybe we've invented new ways of distraction that no one could ever imagine. If, you know, I ran for many years the Annenberg Innovation Lab at USC, and our statistics show that the average 18-year-old checked their smartphone 210 times a day. That's not addiction. I don't know what it is. You know, so there are many, you know, questions as to why young people haven't voted, but something is changing. And obviously, candidates like Beto O'Rourke seem to make a difference in a place where no one thought a Democrat could have any chance of winning. At least he got close.
You also suggested earlier that the media play a role. Rush Limbaugh, Alex Jones, on radio, and then Fox with people like Sean Hannity. Are you suggesting they have had an outsized influence on the people who are likely to vote for Trump? Would those people have been likely to vote for Trump if they hadn't been there?
No, they wouldn't. You know, classically, Geraldo Rivero said a few weeks ago to Sean Hannity, gee, if you'd been around in, you know, when Nixon was being impeached, he wouldn't have been impeached. And he's probably right. You know, the point that I make in the article is that this interregnum that we're in started, you know, in 1989. And really, a bunch of things happened. For the first thing that happened was that Reagan got rid of the fairness doctrine, which many of your listeners don't know what that was, but for many years, from 1945 until 1989, broadcasters had an obligation to present both sides of any issue. In other words, they couldn't be a purely partisan enterprise. And once that was gotten rid of, then you have Rush Limbaugh comes into New York. You have, within 4 years, he's on 500 stations. And you have, then you get Fox News. So you have this purely partisan, essentially state media today in terms of the role of Fox and Limbaugh and Hannity to Trump. They're essentially his propaganda organization. The second thing you had in 89 was the beginning of what is now known as reality TV. Fox, which was a kind of a very new broadcasting entity at that time, there was a writer's strike, and so they didn't have the backlog of programming that all the other networks had, and so they had to make up shows that didn't require writers. And so they created this show called Cops, which was the first reality show. And the funny thing is that the term reality show is obviously a misnomer. They're just as scripted as anything, as anyone who's watched The Bachelor or The Apprentice knows. It's all planned out. But the notion that it was real when it wasn't real was something that Trump grasped better than almost anybody. In other words, it didn't have to be real. It just had to. It didn't have to be true. It just had to be dramatic.
And now we even send people naked out into the wilderness to survive.
Right.
Is not exactly the most realistic scenario.
Right. And you know right off camera there's a nice warm tent where they're able to sit. You know, so the point is that Trump understood that nothing had to be true. It just had to be dramatic. And that's why everybody's, like, so crazed about, oh, it's so chaotic in the White House. That's part of the point. All he's interested in is that you pay attention to him. And if you're wondering who's going to get fired today, just like the plot of The Apprentice, you're fired, then that's, you're playing into Trump's tricks. That the news media are paying attention to every single tweet. I noticed today someone said, Trump hasn't tweeted for 19 hours. What? You know, I mean, this is, who cares? But the point is, that's his plan. So those two things made a huge difference. Obviously, the other two things that happened in 1989 was that the Berlin Wall fell, which, needless to say, removed the modus vivendi for the Republican Party. If anti-communism was not the driving force, it had been for, you know, many years since the end of World War II, and all of a sudden that was gone. So there were people, they were kind of wandering in the wilderness looking for an enemy. And the other thing that happened, of course, was that Tim Berners-Lee conceived the notion of the World Wide Web in 1989. And that, needless to say, changed everything. Because once you had an online community where anybody could be a publisher, where anyone could be a broadcaster, then the gates of hell were opened, and you know, as the New York Times article about Facebook yesterday shows, you know, there was no stopping it.
Interestingly, the two wars that the U.S. fought against communist regimes were actually begun by Democratic presidents and kind of ended by Republican presidents. So it's a complex history, isn't it?
Absolutely, I agree. You know, I think the Democrats have been almost less understanding of the power of the military-industrial complex than the Republicans. I mean, needless to say, a Republican president named the enemy, Eisenhower, and said that they would have undue influence. And, you know, the Democrats have never been able to wrestle with that. They've never been able, I mean, you know, probably the greatest disappointment for me was both Clinton's presidency, which you come in right after the fall of the Berlin Wall, you would assume you were going to get your peace dividend. And, of course, we never got it. He didn't cut the defense budget at all. And then Obama, running against the Iraq War, comes in and the defense budget actually goes up. So, I mean, nobody can say that the Democratic Party has really been very good in dealing with the fact that 65% of the discretionary spending of your tax dollars every year goes to the military. That's unlike any other country in the world. And when you travel to China or you travel to Europe or someplace and you see these gleaming airports and these high-speed trains and you wonder, what the hell happened? And then you realize, as the Wall Street Journal said, we spent $2.7 trillion in Iraq and Syria in the last few years. You know, $2.7 trillion goes a long way to rebuild infrastructure in this country.
Getting back to the Fairness Act, would we have been allowed to have this conversation in the old days, or without me then promising to have somebody from the other side come onto the show to present the opposing viewpoint?
You would have had to have someone who came on and said, this idea is wrong. Or you would have to find someone who opposed that. Now, you wouldn't have to give them exactly equal time, but you would have to at least let someone propose a dissent. Now,
that's called CNN, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
The CNN panels always seem to have at least one conservative. Who will defend the current situation.
And when you read a normal New York Times story, there's usually, on the one hand, on the other hand, points of view presented, you know? I mean, they don't try and just tilt it one way, but that's not like it's not like the Sean Hannity show, you know, on Fox, where you never hear the other side.
And maybe MSNBC as well, but so to some degree, what happens now is we gravitate toward the news, the people who are going to give us the news that we want to hear.
Right. And we have social networks which have algorithms that make sure we only hear what we like. You know, I mean, obviously Facebook long ago understood that you don't want to see opposing viewpoints to your political worldview, and so they'll make sure you only get in your newsfeed stuff which will reinforce what you believe in. And it doesn't matter to them whether you're a right-wing crazy or in Antifa. You know, they'll give you what you need.
You're listening to Leonard Lopit at Large. What did you make of the voter turnout for the midterms? Were you surprised that it was as large as it was?
I was pleased. I was especially pleased that in the Southwest, Latino turnout, which in midterms has been usually pretty low, was really quite strong. Wasn't quite strong enough to pull Beto over the finish line, but it was a lot better than it had been in the past, and the same in Orange County. I mean, Orange County, California, used to be considered the heart of the Republican Party. It's where Nixon had his house, you know. And now Katie Porter won this morning, was declared the winner. I mean, I don't think there's a Republican left in Orange County in the congressional representation for California. So, I mean, and a lot of that is because Latinos are moving into these areas, and they're voting with the Democrats. And also, obviously, the young people are voting with the Democrats.
We mentioned the Electoral College earlier playing a major role in how national elections play out. Also, gerrymandering. The Electoral College has awarded the presidency to the loser of the popular vote twice in the past years. But what about what you were just referring to, statewide elections? In Florida and Texas, for example, the cities and suburbs voted overwhelmingly for the Democratic candidates, and yet the rural areas prevailed, which would suggest that there are still conservative majorities in those states. Or is gerrymandering playing a role there as well?
I think gerrymandering is really the reason behind a lot of that. I mean, it certainly seems to me that if the Democrats win the majority of the vote and lose, in Ohio, in the local legislation, I mean, in the state legislation, Republicans have a supermajority, won a supermajority in the lower house, in the Ohio State Legislature, and yet the Democrats took 52% of the vote.
Well,
so you can only say that that's gerrymandering.
In a number of states, the new governors are Democrats, and so are the attorneys general. So do you expect to see, and in some cases the legislatures have become Democratic majority.
Yep.
So are we likely to see some changes made? Do we have to wait until the 2020 census before we can see changes made?
But those would take place before the 2020 election. So this is a good thing. I mean, look, my hope is that they do what California and Pennsylvania have done, which is essentially turn it over to an independent commission to try and draw them rationally and not let politicians design their own districts. That seems to me to be the solution. And where that's happened, it actually works out pretty well for the Democrats. Because it's not like we have to get in there and just do the same thing the Republicans do, draw these incredibly complicated districts so that we win. I think what is needed is to do what a lot of states, I think Washington and Oregon have the same thing, which is appoint an independent commission to draw them based around county lines and things that look like geographic districts. And it made a huge difference in Pennsylvania, and it got done quickly. I mean, the judges only threw out the Republican gerrymander sometime in the summer, and they got it done in time for the election.
But how have the courts ruled generally? Not all the courts have ruled the way Pennsylvania has.
Well, look, the courts have been fairly sympathetic to this progressive federalism movement. In other words, the California Attorney General Xavier Becerra has sued the Trump administration 26 times. So far, he hasn't lost yet any of those things. Now, these things are moving themselves up, and as I say in the piece, the ultimate irony of this is that this is going to end up at the Supreme Court. And then you have something that's pretty interesting, which is that in the past, the conservatives, Alito, Roberts, Thomas, Gors- Gorsuch, we don't know about Kavanaugh yet, but have all ruled in cases asserting the right of states to set their own policies and saying that the federal government cannot impose itself on the states to make very specific laws. Most recently, New Jersey decided it wanted to allow sports betting, and the federal government tried to stop that, and the Supreme Court ruled for New Jersey. So it seems to me that if these people have real principles and they're originalists, then they will understand that the 10th Amendment gives the states a lot of leeway to do what they want to do. Now, if they're just purely transactional Republican Supreme Court justices, then maybe they'll throw out their originalist principles and say, no, California can't have its own clean car law, or it can't have its own privacy law, or all the other things that Trump has sued us about. But we will see. I mean, this is going to be a real test of just whether these people are principled originalists, or they're just transactional politicians masquerading as justices.
You write, I'm quoting, the problem of minority rule has plagued the nation from its inception, and we've talked a bit about that. It led to our civil war. The national security expert Keith Mines estimates, you note, as he told Foreign Policy, that the United States faces over the next 10 to 15 years a 60% chance of civil war, some variety of violent political conflict on a large scale. He talking about shooting and secession?
I'd say what he's talking about is what happened 3 weeks ago, duplicated 50 times. In other words, pipe bombs in the mailboxes of Democratic leaders, or shootings inside, synagogues based on the thinking that they were helping immigrants across the border. You've seen the right wing ability, whether it's in Charlottesville or even in these events, in the past month, to escalate the violence to levels that we didn't think possible. You and I both went through the late 60s when, a lot of that bombing of federal buildings was coming from the left, but we don't have to wonder whether this could happen. It has happened. Then the question is, does it escalate? Trump, in that Daily Caller interview the other day, he said, well, the Antifa just better worry that the right-wing paramilitaries don't start flexing their muscles because they're going to be a lot stronger. So, what is he doing? He's essentially saying, like he used to do in his rallies.
It sounds like a threat.
Yeah.
Now, slavery and the 10th Amendment were at the heart of the conflict that led to the Civil War. How could the 10th Amendment, which grants any power not specifically reserved to the federal government to the states, help avert a civil war this time?
Well, here's the deal. If we really take the 10th Amendment seriously, then it says essentially that in an issue like health care, if California wanted to have universal health care, a state-run single-payer system, it should be able to do that. Vermont almost did it, and then pulled back at the last minute because of a Republican governor came in. But the point is that these issues, which seem to be so contentious, think of the number of votes the Republicans have issued to try and, eliminate Obamacare. So these issues if they're so contentious, why don't we let the states that want to have single payer have single payer?
Because it was a federal law.
If Mississippi doesn't want to have single payer, fine.
But isn't the fact that it was enacted through a federal law an important factor here?
What the
Obamacare is a federal law. So wouldn't the states just have to come up with their own health care bills rather than try to sustain Obamacare?
Okay, so here's the question: if we make a decision that we want to have some kind of universal single payer, it may be that those experiments have to start at the state level. In the same way that, you know, quite frankly, 10 years ago, Massachusetts was the only state where if a gay couple could marry, right? I mean, these things start at a local level and eventually build till it becomes the law of the land. So my take on it is the basic social insurance thing, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, have to be national, just because the whole basis of insurance, of having the largest pool possible, makes that work. But around the incremental sides of these issues, there are many experimental ideas that could happen. Now, maybe healthcare is not the easiest one to pull off, but certainly the fact that California is fighting the Trump administration to keep its very strict emission control law is important, because California is a very large market, and the auto manufacturers have decided if California says that by 2040 you have to have a car that gets 50 miles per gallon on the average of the fleet, we're going to have to achieve that, because we're not going to not sell cars in California. So that ability for a single state to push that, and then, needless to say, what happens is 12 other states have raised their hand and say, we want to do the same thing as California. So that's how these changes happen.
It's also been pointed out that clean air doesn't just stay in one state. If there's a power plant that is spewing out nasty toxins, it will spread over a whole bunch of states.
Agree.
Even if one state enacts good laws, what happens to the neighboring state?
So what have we done? We have something called the Western States Compact. So we have New Mexico, Arizona, California, Oregon, and Washington have all agreed to a single carbon market. Okay, it's not the perfect solution, but it says to me that these kind of regional solutions can happen. And so, I mean, the point is, I believe, despite the fact that Democrats now control the House of Representatives, that Washington is basically going to be a place for the next 10 to 15 years where progressive legislation goes to die. That nothing of really important will change, because the Senate is only going to get more Republican, as this election proved. Democrats won 52-53% of the nationwide vote, and yet the Republicans gained 3 seats in the Senate, and maybe more.
And that's just because as President Trump suggested early in his political career, the system is rigged?
Well, the system was rigged by the founders to give small states with no population just as much vote as big states with, you know, I mean, so Montana has, 480,000 citizens, and California has almost 40 million citizens, and they both have the same voting power in the state, in the Senate. That that sounds rigged to me. But as I said earlier, I don't think we can fix it.
Was the 10th Amendment intended to protect slavery? And later, of course, it was used to protect Jim Crow, which has made states' rights actually a kind of a negative phrase for progressives for a long time. Now they're suddenly invoking states' rights.
Well, look, I mean, the history of the 10th Amendment came out of, it's the last amendment of the Bill of Rights. And that was Jefferson's insistence after the Constitution was done, signed, sealed, and delivered. Jefferson came back from France and insisted that we have a Bill of Rights. And the last amendment of that was the 10th Amendment, because Jefferson still believed that the states should be independent in terms of their internal affairs and shouldn't be forced. You know, obviously he was opposed to Hamilton's view that the federal government should be able to do whatever it wants to do. So, but there's no doubt that the history of states' rights, although, as I point out in the article, states have done in the past progressive things. You know, Montana gave women the vote long before they got the vote nationally. But as somebody like yourself and myself who grew up in the 60s, the notion of states' rights is associated with George Wallace standing in the schoolhouse door trying to keep black kids out of a school. I understand it has a lot of baggage. But the point was, in 1963, when John Kennedy was still president, the power of progressive change was invested in the president and in the federal government. And the power of regressive change was in states like Mississippi. Today, power of regressive change is in the White House. The EPA, Trump would like to eliminate any, you know, clean air allowance. The Interior Department is a sinkhole of corruption. Betsy DeVos would like to change the whole way we do education. And you know, Wilbur Ross is another corrupt politician, you know, talking his own book. So there's no way that you can say, oh, gee, we're going to get progressive change out of the White House or out of the Senate. And so, but yet, in California, extraordinary things are happening on a monthly basis of really important progressive legislation. When Trump got rid of the net neutrality law, California put one in. Now, California is too big a market for, you know, Comcast and AT&T and Verizon to ignore. So they're going to have to, you know, have net neutrality again.
Before we go, should we be surprised that you wrote a book on that, Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy, and also this article in Harper's, Rebirth of a Nation, Can States' Rights Save Us from a Second Civil War? Because your background was originally in music and film. You produced concerts for Bob Dylan and the band, and then produced Martin Scorsese's Mean Streets. And you've been working in the film industry for a long time. How did you wind up moving into this area?
Well, I mean, I wrote my book because obviously I had been in academia for 14 years at the University of Southern California running the Annenberg Innovation Lab. I was thinking a lot about how media and culture were working, but it also came out of a personal kind of sense of irritation when I saw my friend, Levon Helm, who was the drummer in the band, get throat cancer in the year 2000 and see, I could go on YouTube and there would be songs like The Wait or The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down with 3 or 4 million streams, and not a penny of that was flowing into Levon's pockets. He could hardly pay for his health insurance, and it just seemed wrong. And I came to realize that the internet was not helping the creative class, that newspapers were dying because Facebook and Google were taking the music industry 75% because all this free music was out there on YouTube. So, I mean, that's how it started. I mean, I just was pissed off. And then eventually I came to realize that as much as I thought things needed to happen, nothing was happening in terms of regulatory issues in Washington. You know, the Federal Trade Commission could see that Google was completely gaming the system, and yet, even though the staff at the FTC wanted to find Google, Obama stopped them because he thought it was political suicide for Democrats to take on Silicon Valley. So, I mean, and here we see yesterday in the NYT article, you know, Chuck Schumer protecting Facebook because his daughter was working there, and he tells Mark Warner to back off. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So that's when I began to think, well, look, maybe at the state level, things can happen. And then, you know, I started working with the California people, and, you know, we passed a privacy regulation that's just as strong as the one in Europe. Now, it doesn't go into place till 2020, but still, it's a big change.
And you don't miss doing documentaries for PBS and movies like The Last Waltz or Until the End of the World, Under Fire, and To Die For?
Well, I might do another. There's a great young filmmaker is making a film on my book, so, and I'm helping him with that. But, I'm enjoying writing. It's a different life, and, it's a life that suits me now.
A life of journalism. And you have another article coming for Harper's? Because this one...
I'm working on it. It's not there yet, but I'm working on it.
Yeah,
yes.
I've learned in the past not to ask people what it's about.
Yes. Right.
But meanwhile, we have this one called Rebirth of a Nation, kind of a reference to films. Rebirth of a Nation, Can States' Rights Save Us from a Second Civil War? And my great thanks to Jonathan Taplin for talking with us today on Leonard Lopate at Large.
It's been a great pleasure, Leonard.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Jonathan Taplin, to Angela Shelton, who produced this segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my producer, Jesse Lent, who makes things run smoothly. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.